Oh, I typed it wrong. Okay. You're going to want to cut this out.
You think?
I have to pee in a little bit anyway. Hey folks, thanks for tuning in to yet another Mouth Fist podcast. I'm Steve Saunders.
I'm Ryan Speck.
Ryan, which Mouth Fist podcast is this? How many have we done so far?
This is episode 5.
Episode 5.
Yes, and we have received no comments or hate mail, so we have to assume that Clive Barker did not listen to the last episode.
Or any other Hellraiser fan, which basically means people. Okay, well,
given the huge response, obviously nobody listened to the last episode, which, good on them. I don't know if an hour and 40 minutes of Hellraiser was for anybody other than us.
That left me exhausted, man.
Yeah, imagine how I felt having to edit it.
That left me exhausted just thinking about you editing it. So
by the end, I wanted to kill you and then hang myself.
That's why, folks,
I really hated you, and I thought about quitting doing this podcast ever again.
Mouth Fist will end in a murder suicide. Although, that means Ryan. So when Ryan starts asking about clipper prices, I know I'm doomed. And
yeah. What's your schedule like this week, Steve?
A whole lot of sitting at home and writing.
When are you going to be hanging around your house? What hours are you generally asleep? Which window do you leave unlocked?
I'm trying to look up an address of someone I don't like.
To give to me?
Yes, to give to you. In fact,
because I can't tell other people apart from you, so I'll just murder them.
That's true. You're
not Steve. I wish I hadn't have killed you.
But you really don't, because Ryan actually lacks human empathy.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. It's totally true. This is basically, this is a podcast that is essentially starring a sociopathic glue huffer and Ryan.
So. Yes, that is true.
Pretty much. Anyway, well, what's new with you this week, Ryan?
Well, I figured we could go back and forth and talk a little bit about some of the things we have been doing. I don't know if you've been watching much TV lately. I know that you keep pretty busy these days. Have you been watching anything on TV? Because my TV has been hampered by the fact that my girlfriend has been working pretty much 12 hours a day since 7 days a week since New Year's, so we are so far behind on TV, it's not funny. I'm just now catching up with some of the like first 3 or 4 episodes of the new season of Archer.
Ooh, I need to watch that. They started showing Being Human, the British version, on Space, because the US version is terrible. And
really? A lot of people seem to like it. I mean, I don't care one way or the other. I probably wouldn't like either of them, but
it's not Flash Gordon terrible, but the actors, I like the actors on board. It's got one of my favorite bit actors from Battlestar Galactica. It's got another actor who's really funny, and it's got some chick. And
that kid that's on the American version. Yeah, I had seen him in some other stuff. I didn't realize that he was actually in the show until one of my friends mentioned it. Apparently, people like the show, which is odd, but I mean, I guess standards vary. I think one of the people that liked Being Human is Mike, and Mike liked Smallville. So,
well, to use a loan word from the Ryan Speck lexicon, I would say my viewing experience is hampered by the fact that I'm a fan of the admittedly shitty British version, which I remember someone actually famous saying that it's a terrible, terrible show. But I'm not British, so all British people sound, even though I grew up around British kids and Germans who spoke with a British accent, all British people sound educated to me. Even the people who are essentially like, you know, a back alley chav or whatever.
They're sort of Cockney chav scum.
They sound like they're awesome. And so the British accents make it better. As retarded as that sounds, and the acting is much better in the it's not really the US version actor's fault. It's because they're just terribly written and directed.
Whereas it's probably also the fact that in Britain, it's not seen as so much of a, like, genre entry. It's something that people watch on TV. People aren't quite so, like, ooh, sci-fi, we can't watch that. Yeah. That's not going to be on normal television. I mean, Heroes was odd in the fact that it was a superhero show, basically, on network television. Yeah. Like, people don't watch that shit on network TV. They watch doctor and lawyer shows and stupid sitcoms. And
crime procedurals. Yeah. And Hoarders. But
basically fitting into the doctor, lawyer, police show.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
Triumvirate. They rotate in their popularity every probably decade. It switches from being lawyer shows are hot to doctor shows are hot to police shows are hot. And then doctor shows, lawyer shows. It's, it just jumps back and forth between the same three genre professions.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's the British version. I don't think people really cared that it was like ostensibly a science fiction fantasy show, whereas in America that shit gets relegated to Sci-Fi Channel and nobody watches it.
Well, Britain's really weird when it comes to fantasy and sci-fi. According to my British friends, you never want to admit that you play Dungeons and Dragons because only basement dwelling neckbeard trolls from Yorkshire play Dungeons and Dragons.
But Warhammer is perfectly okay.
But Warhammer seems to be perfectly acceptable. And I don't know, maybe they're viewed as basement-dwelling neckbeard trolls. And but it's also, Doctor Who is very popular there.
Yeah.
And no matter how hard they try to make Doctor Who cool, I like Doctor Who, but I also grew up reading 2000 AD. Spaced is one of my absolute favorite shows of all time. And I've watched a shitload of British television, so I'm already used to it. But if you show most Americans things like Doctor Who or Blackadder or Red Dwarf, they just kind of roll their eyes, especially Doctor Who, which is admittedly incredibly terrible.
I was watching those David Mitchell soapboxes that I pointed out to you yesterday, and one of them actually talks about programming towards children and the fact that it's kind of dumbing down television in general, but it pointed out specifically as an example, Doctor Who, the fact that Doctor Who is a children's show in Britain, and Britain is considered to be made for children. In America, it's watched by a bunch of like 20 to 30 year old nerds, but in Britain, it's considered like a family show that's mainly written and aimed at children, and adults just happen to like watching it too.
I like to call them vacuum cleaner model fetishists, which is a real word salad there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I never developed the taste for it. I used to watch it on PBS back in the days of Tom Baker and Sylvester McCoy. But, yeah, I kind of liked it. But, I mean, there was such a dearth of decent science fiction on television. It was just something to watch and at, like, 1 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday night. It's the new stuff is kind of bad beyond comprehension. Like, I tried watching it back during the Christopher Eccleston season. I was like, nope, I'm out. This is just too awful.
I'm out. Yeah.
Yeah, I think me and Shreya got through like 3 episodes and it's like, nope, we're not that bored.
Yeah. Well, in back to the Being Human, apparently the premise of the show is a vampire, a werewolf, and a ghost all live together.
Yeah.
And, like, the beginning it's of a like terrible
the,
joke.
Yeah, I was about to say, it's, like, the worst, like, joke you've ever heard. A ghost and a vampire and a werewolf walk into a bar.
Mm-hmm. And the guy who plays the vampire left the show. Apparently, he's going to be a dwarf on The Hobbit. Or in The Hobbit. He's going to be
British version? What? I'm guessing? This is the British version?
The British. Yeah, I don't talk about the U.S. version. Okay. But
we'll never speak of that again.
Well, I mean, unless I say that the American version, the original version of Being Human. The new season or series, as they're called in England.
So he left off at the beginning of this season?
He left last season, like at the end of last season. And the guy who plays the werewolf, who is the only constant since the original pilot, which had a different vampire and ghost, the only constant from that point is he left. Like, his character, I think, died, and then he's coming back to do some other stuff. The ghost, Annie, is still the same from episode one of the series is still the same actress, which it made me realize that as much as I like to look at her and she'd be great in a comedy, I really don't like
miscast for that show.
I don't like her character. No, she's just a terribly written character. She's annoying.
So it's less the actress and more the writing.
Yeah.
Yeah. The premise never really struck me as something I would have found interesting. I mean, it sounds like just a way to try to fit genre elements into a show that's ostensibly just going to be about young people struggling to come to terms with who they are in modern society.
Right.
But instead of, like, the guy being gay, he's a werewolf or something. It's like, okay, yeah, we get the simile and metaphor there. You don't have to beat us over the head with it.
Correct.
It didn't really seem like the type of thing that it really needed to be about a vampire, werewolf, and a ghost. But I guess it makes for a marketing point, at least. But
yeah, although I do like the new werewolf and a new vampire, I think the show lost me. I don't like when they make major cast changes. Maybe we should just kill the show. Hmm. So
yeah. And I can imagine there hasn't been that many episodes overall. I know British...
This is the fourth season, and there's about...
Yeah, seasons are, what, usually like 6 or 8 episodes per season?
These are 8. I think the first season or series was 6 episodes, if I remember correctly. Or maybe they expanded to 8 because it became very popular.
Yeah, I guess it's a good thing that the British import so many American shows now, because Jesus Christ, how would they have enough television to fill all of the networks they keep adding?
Oh, I know. There's, I need to catch up on Justified.
Oh, God, yeah. Like, I haven't watched this week's episode, but there are very few things that we've been keeping up on. Sharia will make some time in her schedule for Castle, because she loves Castle. I mean, it's kind of crappy, but it's supposed to be, because I guess the idea of the show is it's written to be, like, a crappy crime novel, so the fact that the plots are often a little stupid is not a flaw of the series so much as just... That's kind of the thesis of the series. It's supposed to be like a bad James Patterson crime novel or something.
Right.
Sexy crime novel. But yeah, Castle, up all night with Will Arnett and Christina Applegate. That's loves that show, which is pretty funny. Yeah. Have you been watching that at all?
I haven't watched any recent episodes.
You haven't seen the episode where Will Arnett does a dead-on impersonation of Michael Keaton?
No.
I love that episode. There's just something deeply funny about him doing a Michael Keaton impression, since it's perfect. Quoting lines from, like, Mr. Mom and Batman, I think.
That's awesome. Will Arnett is definitely one of my favorite actors.
It was a surprisingly good show. I wasn't sure, based on, like, the ads and stuff they showed before the season started, if it was going to be any good, but I gave it a chance because it was Will Arnett and Christina Applegate.
Right.
But it turned out to be a lot better than I would have expected. It's been a pretty funny show. I wish I'd been keeping up more on 30 Rock, but... But Sharia's actually been a little more willing to watch it this season. We just haven't had time to keep up on it too much because... The first few episodes were a little, like, shaky. They weren't necessarily all that funny, and then it got right back up to par. Though it was kind of amusing to see them touch on the whole subject of Tracy Morgan making the comments about in his comedy act about that got the gay community all in an uproar, making fun of that in the actual show.
Mm-hmm.
Did you catch that episode?
I don't think so. Like, I haven't seen 30 Rock in...
Since, like, sometime last season?
Yeah, because my girlfriend doesn't like it.
Really?
So, yeah.
Well, I guess they have that in common then. My girlfriend didn't really like it either, though she was willing to watch it anyway. I don't think she hates it, and I think it's growing on her over time, especially now that Comedy Central's showing it, and I'll often have it on while I'm cooking dinner, because it's on right between 7 and 8, and she'll see parts of episodes that she's seen before and finds them funny. I think it's just, like, the pace of the comedy. There's just a lot of jokes, and they're all kind of absurd and crazy, and there's just a lot of shit going on every episode. I think it's a little bit too much for her.
Right. And to be fair, my Nicole doesn't like most TV and is really only excited about documentaries and certain shows like Game of Thrones. And
then we will never speak of your girlfriend again.
Oh no, Nicole's awesome. She's an amazing artist and also is into a lot of this, into nearly almost everything I'm into. It's just except that she's not much of a TV watcher.
Then she and I shall have nothing to speak of.
Ah.
Sorry, Nicole.
I would rather
not going to be BFFs.
I'd rather be with someone, though, that is into, like, Game of Thrones and watching cool science. Like, she also loves sci-fi fantasy. Than somebody who's, like, obsessed with watching Intervention, Orders, and all those, like, the Duggars. I call them the Duergar.
For fuck's sake.
I call them the Duergar because they're like little retarded gully dwarves or some shit. And
Jesus Christ. Those people need to be set on fire.
Right. And I
am not kidding. I mean, literally, someone should murder those people.
And I like to, like, you know, this is where I start making digs at one of my ex-girlfriends who I think is a complete bitch. And basically the point is,
I guess she'll never hear this, so it doesn't matter.
She'll never hear this. Yeah, it doesn't matter. And if someone
nobody hears this, so I don't know why she would.
And her friends who do hear this will just giggle and know that I'm telling the truth. But yeah, watching, you know, some depressed alcoholic high on pills, watching Intervention with me saying, "Oh, it's so terrible that they go through this," and I just want to like murder people because I can't stand those kind of shows. I hate them. I think they're one, I hate watching people like that, and two, I hate watching people like that get exploited for money. Even though I'm fully okay with gladiatorial combat amongst people, but
volunteer. The only one of those shows that I really enjoyed was like the first 48 on A&E, because I mean it's basically a documentary about crime investigation. Even though to a certain extent, having the cameras there has influenced police response and the way that they've treated some of the cases. Like in one case, a 6 or 8 year old girl got shot because the police wanted to show off for the first 48. So they sent in like a SWAT team to the wrong apartment and shot a little girl in the fucking head or something.
What? That's not even funny. But I almost
laughed. It's not funny. It's the fucking Detroit police though. So it's almost Detroit, expected.
Yeah. Detroit is where like even people that live in Mordor won't go to Detroit. We already covered Hellraiser, so let's skip Detroit. And I do have a reality show I do like watching sometimes, like really rarely, and that's Lockup and Lockdown, which are they are different shows, kind of like Hoarders and Hoarding Buried Alive are different shows, though I can't
tell. Every network for a long time has had to start replicating shows. The first time I remember it really being apparent was probably back around like 2005, 2006, somewhere around there, when A&E had Flip This House, and then TLC did Flip That House, which was really confusing reading a guide and going through like channels and being like, oh, that's on. It's like, hold on, this isn't that show. What the fuck? But yeah, it's like everybody in the community between TLC, History Channel, Discovery, they all have to constantly, and A&E, of course, compete and regurgitate the same concept between, like, 5 different shows. The worst, obviously, is, like, the retarded ghost-hunting paranormal horseshit shows.
It just goes to show that nothing in TV land or Hollywood is, like, they'll be like, hey, we got, like, a ghost of an elephant and a giraffe are hanging out with the chainsaw, and then and then there'll be 6 movies just like that, and then they'll all come around the same time because all these people talk amongst each other and ideas.
Yeah, they hear
around
that something's in production in another studio, so they rush production on their thing to either get it out before or at the same time.
Right,
like,
which is
like those little shitty like movie companies that will put out a movie on DVD right before like the war. They do the War of the Worlds right before the
Snakes on a Train. Yeah.
Yeah. Those companies, they have it out usually at the same time, either on Sci-Fi Channel or direct to DVD. Like, yeah, they did that with Thor. When Thor came out same day, they had a Thor movie that was really terrible on a Sci-Fi Channel.
Not just that. It's also like, you know, Armageddon and Deep Impact and like all the big
there
budget.
Used to be a lot more, I guess, parity between companies trying to do the same movie or the same concept. A lot of times it was just weird coincidence. Supposedly like the story of the guys that created Man Thing.
I was thinking the same thing. Yeah.
Don't know obviously if that's completely true, but I mean, obviously a lot of movie companies, they will like buy a script and green light a movie, and then in the long period of time it took, especially back in the 90s, to make the film, the fact that it happened to come out within a month of another movie was probably more coincidental, but just really unfortunate because obviously it completely overshadows that other the movies overshadow each other, like Mission to Mars and Red Planet.
Yep.
Obviously, like you were talking about Deep Impact and what was the other one?
Armageddon.
Yeah.
I was going to say, for our listeners' benefit, the story of Man-Thing and Swamp-Thing, where one is a plant that comes to life as a man-type thing, Man-Thing, and the other one is a person who becomes a swamp plant, in a nutshell. I believe I've got that correct. Even though I'm a fan of Man Thing,
I'm not sure about Man Thing, but yeah. So they had very different concepts, but yeah.
But they were created by two roommates.
Yeah.
Over the same weekend, and they swear up and down, probably for legal reasons, because one is Marvel and one is DC. Marvel has Man Thing, and DC has Swamp Thing, and they were created at the same time, roughly. And by the same guys who live together, and I if I have that correct.
Yes. From what I remember, yes, you are correct. Yeah, it was very odd. I mean, obviously, they kind of ended up being very different concepts. Man-Thing was very weird. Swamp mm-hmm. Thing was a little more straightforward.
Until Alan
Guy.
Alan
it was more of a Frankenstein, like, meets Beauty and the Beast sort of story, where you got a guy turned into a monster, whereas Man Thing was very weird.
Yeah, and like more about the guest characters.
And it was just strange. I mean, it's this creature that wants to be left alone, and whenever, what is it? Like, he will just start like burning and feeling this suffering that can only be sated by like stopping something or other. I can't remember. Yeah.
He's basically Ghost Rider.
Yeah, he's kind of Ghost Rider, except in a really weird, creepy, tragic way.
Yep. Yeah, he's in
because a giant lumbering swamp monster does not make for a good spirit of vengeance.
I was gonna say
that'd be a great team up though if you think about it. Fuck, like Johnny Blaze and Ghost Rider working together, Man Thing and Ghost Rider.
Man Thing, Ghost Rider, that'd be awesome. Well, the thing is, and I think Ghost Rider did bump into Man Thing in one of the older comics I was reading as a kid, if I remember correctly. I used to read the shit out of Ghost Rider and Man Thing as a child. The thing about Swamp Thing became weird like Man Thing when Alan Moore took over.
Yeah.
Swamp Thing. That's where we got John Constantine. It is Constantine. And that's you know Hellblazer. And it's all really like interesting. I don't even know why we're talking about Man Thing now. But
well, why not talk about Man Thing, Steve?
Why not? Yeah, I don't know. Another thing.
Yeah, it was actually tied, I guess, to my first real superhero comic was Marvel Comics Presents number one, which was Wolverine, Man-Thing, and Master of Kung Fu.
Pretty good combo.
Not really, but I think the only thing I ever read a second time was the Wolverine part.
Yeah. Well, on totally different, like, we're talking about stuff that's like how Hollywood and TV and in comic books, because really DC and Marvel have all the same characters or just different aspects of each other. I just watched with Nicole, The Greatest Movie Ever Sold.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a very interesting film. I mean, he doesn't make the most complex, long documentaries. It felt pretty short.
Mm-hmm.
I would have liked to have seen a lot more of it because
I could have watched another
really
hour.
Fun movies. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it was a really good film. I was glad I finally got to see it.
Yeah. I mean, I found it compelling and tell me anything I didn't know already about that industry.
I don't really know how I feel about his new San Diego Comic-Con documentary thing, but...
Well, he goes where the money is. I mean...
Well, I mean, it's kind of about... I think... I mean, he's done a bunch of different things. Obviously, for a long time, he was busy doing... what was it? 30 Days on FX,
mm-hmm.
where it was... He did that for, like, two seasons, where basically somebody goes and like lives a completely different lifestyle or has to deal with something
for
like 30 days. He did like quite a few of them himself. He spent like 30 days in prison. He spent 30 days living on him and his wife living on minimum wage.
And now they're divorced.
Well, good, because I fucking hated her. Did you watch...
The Vegan Chef?
Did you watch... Did you watch Supersize Me and find her nagging and just so goddamn irritating you wanted to fucking stab her in the eye?
Well, Ryan, being someone who's had a lot of girlfriends in his life, it's because there's two reasons why I've had a lot of like short-term and long-term girlfriends, and that's because one
of them is that they eventually get to know you and then want to leave.
Correct. That's
and the second is that the lock on your trunk breaks and they get away.
Shush. Don't give that away. So three, then the third reason, there's three reasons then. So after they discover that I'm a giant preening douchebag, and then two, that they escape from the trunk. Fucking escape artist. Apparently I have a thing for them. And three, I realize that I am an impulsive shopper and am like, yay, the girl, blah, blah, blah. And it wasn't until my 30s when I was like, oh, well, I should be more discerning. So, which I, of course, after my marriage ended, I did torture myself with a, you know, actually, I had a couple good, like, short-term relationships and one really bad long one. So,
yeah.
And now I'm in
the opposite problem of you. I'm incredibly frank and probably abrasive to every girl I meet, so I would weed out the people that sucked real fast. I've only had, like, basically two big long-term relationships in my entire life that have made up pretty much all of the time since I was 19 until now.
Well, I'm just as abrasive and funny and stuff or whatever, but to girls, they always think that's cute initially, and then I get on their nerves.
I never had that experience at all. Yeah. They never thought it was cute with me.
Because I
wasn't doing it the way you were doing it. I mean, like, abrasive, like, aren't you a stupid cunt?
Well, as I say in my Depressolin entries, everything that a girl likes me for, she will hate me for within 6 months, like, mm-hmm. or sooner. She will, like, oh, Steve, I like the fact that you speak your mind. And then 6 months later, I hate the fact that you embarrass me at parties. You embarrass me at parties because you had to tell the guy who was a Republican to shut the fuck up and his eyes are made from cunts. I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, what's wrong with that? And okay, I apologize for calling his eyes cunts. So, you know, like it's or like, you know, oh, I really like that you're fearless and you get out there and you're just unafraid to do anything. And then like 6 months later, it's like, why are you unafraid to tell me I'm a bitch? So, and I'm still pretty nice. I mean, my Nicole is actually a great catch, so I hopefully I don't fuck it up. But, she actually is a good balance and I listen to her and she accepts the fact that I'm kind of a preening douchebag and she loves me regardless and lets me know if I'm getting too douchebaggy.
I have to wonder what's wrong with this girl, because there's got to be something majorly wrong with her.
I don't know.
Does she have a head injury, Steve? Are you her sugar daddy? What kind of hold do you have over this woman?
She doesn't get out of the trunk, I guess. So yeah. It's
she was never any good with locks.
She's never. I gave up on my escape artist fetish.
Yeah. Unfortunately, every girl that you've gone out with before has been much more mechanically inclined than she is.
So my point, by the way, aside from talking about Adeptus Mechanicus girls, is
your German rape dungeon.
You don't know Nicole, do you? So anyway, but the point is,
I'm sure I'll know a lot more about her after I read the true crime article.
But my point is, for the fifth time, is that the vegan chef chick that Morgan Spurlock was married to, I've dated her. Not her specifically. I don't want to, like, scare her. But, you know, like, I've dated that girl.
I've dated her in my dreams. I'm coming for you.
Oh, I tried dating vegans and vegetarians, and it's impossible, because eventually I slap a steak on my face and say, I'm going to motherfucking eat this, and they're like, put clothes on. I'm like, fuck you.
The weird thing is, like, my two major relationships, both of them, when I started going out with them, they were vegetarian. Not really strong vegetarians, but they were like, don't eat meat. They wouldn't eat chicken or beef or anything. Probably not even fish. They avoided meat entirely, and then of course that shit doesn't last long with me, does it?
Nope. And
I'm eating bacon off a deep fried baby, and they're having to join in pretty quickly. Fortunately, that shit has worked out.
Morgan Spurlock's wife, no offense to her, I'm sure he has to get along with her because they have to share custody of their child. Seems like a cute kid, by the way. I just imagine her yelling at him about him being a preening douchebag, saying like, you're so confrontational and argumentative and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, look, honey, I've done the cleansing diet bullshit because Morgan Spurlock strikes me as a guy who's like us. He's probably skeptical, asks a lot of questions.
But he's super nice. He's like nicest guy. So like, for her to be such a bitch all the time, he was always he was almost kind of a sad sack with her. He was just so nice and, like, forgiving of her horseshit.
Dude, I like to call that dating my last girlfriend.
But
I
was super nice. He is very skeptical. So. He's, like, very rational about things. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how that shit survived for as long as it did with her. It does remind me a lot of a almost nice, chemically neutered version of you and your ex-wife.
That's true. I was also, but see, I actually would, to my ex-wife's credit, there is a reason why we divorced, and me going on like a 30-minute yelling rage fit over something like misplacing my books one time, you know, like stuff like that. Like, I'll admit that I was a total asshole sometimes because I was just fed up and we weren't compatible. And I actually get along with my ex-wife now, and we are, you know, get along, and she likes my girlfriend and she approves, and I hope she can find happiness too. And I can make total digs on my ex-wife that are really easy. She's an easy target. But yeah. Yeah. But with like the ex-girlfriend, I was super nice. Like, I never raised my voice to her or argued to her really. And if I said like, well, maybe this, and she'd be like, bah. So to my ex-wife's credit, she wasn't a total like oligarchical princess type. So
yeah.
But I mean, this isn't really about me bitching about my ex-girlfriends and ex-wife.
That's why I said chemically neutered version chemically, of you, because that's true. It bore more similarity to if you had been like a nice guy being with your ex-wife. It really wasn't you. It's more like your ex-wife and somebody else.
Yeah, I don't know. Morgan Spurlock and privately might be like me, who is like, I would fashion myself as I'm a very nice guy who is pissed off at the world because the world is an unfair, unjust, and shitty place. And so I want to poop my poop of vengeance all over the face of the world because you guys are assholes. And I think
he's kind of the opposite. I think he believes that the world is a great place and all people need to do is better understand each other and the world will learn to get along or something.
Well,
I think he has a very kind of idealistic view of the world, which is great because at least he is very proactive about
like
showing people that.
Maybe he is a dark motherfucker in private. He, unlike me or you, he's smart and doesn't actually, you know, put that out there. So, you know, it's like he, you know, like you and I wear it on our sleeve.
Yeah.
He doesn't, probably so he can get money for films. So, I mean, but I can sense
either that or he just isn't that way. I mean, seems just like a nice guy who has a good sense of humor about everything. Mm-hmm. He probably should go into politics or something. He's like, yeah. He's got that kind of anything rolls off of him attitude that he could probably actually do something in politics.
Yeah, but yeah, I tend to be like that in person with people. So whereas, but I don't know, I've actually yelled and screamed at people too. But anyway,
but yeah. So you watched that movie? Yeah.
Yeah, I watched it. I did enjoy it. It was a bit short. I thought right when it started really getting steam, like picking up steam, and I was like really into it. The credits roll. I'm like, no.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I mean, no, I mean, I still would rate it like an 8 out of 10. I'd say I definitely give it.
Yeah. It's great information, even if it feels short. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
And what else is going on?
I think the only thing I watched lately as far as movies was Super, which I'd probably recommend for you to see. I don't know if the average person would really enjoy Super, but you would probably like it. I mean, you like Slither.
Oh, I love Slither.
And, yeah. So it's got a lot of the same cast members. It's got Michael Rooker, and it's got Greg Henry. And
Nathan Fillion?
Yeah, Nathan Fillion's got a little bit part in the movie.
Nice.
Kind of more of a cameo type thing. Mainly stars Rainn Wilson and Ellen Page.
Hmm. Nice.
And Liv Tyler.
And
Kevin Bacon.
Kevin Bacon? Cool.
Yeah, well, Kevin Bacon's kind of the villain of the movie.
I will... And what's Super about?
Super is about a guy whose wife leaves him and he has some sort of weird semi-schizophrenic psychotic break where he sees God and decides to start dressing up as a superhero and beating people with a pipe wrench to stop evil.
Somehow I think I've seen, there was a similar film with Woody Harrelson.
Yeah, it was called Defendor.
But he was
a crazy guy who thought he was a superhero. And yeah, it's kind of similar, except this is an incredible... If you kind of combine Kick-Ass and Defendor...
I might have actually seen
And Taxi
Super.
Driver, it would be Super.
What,
Super came out like a year and a half ago.
I don't think I've seen Super, but I saw something where he died. All right, so anyway.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking dark. It's like as dark as Slither was, and it's incredibly violent and vulgar, so.
So something I'd watch.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was good. It was funny. It was dark. I don't think most people would enjoy it, but I think both of us obviously would. But yeah, it's, yeah, Defendor meets Taxi Driver. Yeah.
Okay, well.
Yeah. So I would recommend you watch that. Sometime we will have to maybe watch something else and give our reports. We talked previously about maybe watching Human Centipede.
Yeah, yeah. We were, was it Human Centipede and a Serbian film?
Yeah, which I've seen. And you would just have to watch that and I would have to refresh my memory.
Yep.
It'd be a hell of a double feature.
a double feature. It'd be like the Hellraiser one, but we just talk about those two films.
Yeah. I'd be more interested in whether or not you end up watching it with your girlfriend.
Well, I'd like to get a reaction.
Yeah. Depending on the girl, that could be a relationship ender right there. But
I'm surprised my relationship hasn't ended yet.
Yeah. That will be the ultimate test. If she can survive that gauntlet, then you will have her for all times.
So moving, well, let's move on if you're okay with that. And yes. I'm thinking, I want to actually mention a book I'm reading right now. It's The Executioner Always Chops Twice, Ghastly Blunders on the Scaffold by Jeffrey Abbott.
Yeah, I read some of the samples of that on Amazon last night after you mentioned it. Yeah. So that seems like it'd be a pretty interesting book.
If you're looking for Ghastly Blunders, this is not the book for you. It's just basically a bunch of different little takes and newspaper or reports and firsthand accounts that Mr. Abbott has compiled together. I mean, this is from like 6 years ago, 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's fun. It's told in kind of a slightly tongue in cheek way. I find it entertaining. I'm reading it on my playbook.
Yeah, the parts I was looking through were covering, I guess, different forms of medieval torture, mm-hmm. and especially the boot.
Yeah, the boot.
I was mainly reading about the boot, but they also had a bit on the rack, and I kind of skipped over that and was just looking at the different parts. It was interesting.
There's some stuff they don't. I haven't quite covered yet in the book. I'm not quite done with it, but it's they don't seem to cover. There's some stuff he didn't cover, or he doesn't go into the full description of, like, you know, there's one he's talking about where essentially it was like a massacre on the scaffold where swordsmen and, you know, it's basically a Scottish scaffold massacre because the swordsmen couldn't slice the heads off properly or whatever. And it just turned into a stabbing contest, you know, or whatever. And it is fun. You have to be kind of like me in the sense that you're kind of a morbid sicko who really enjoys reading about the suffering of others. I read books about execution and torture to lull myself to sleep. And that might make me sound like a terrible human being, but I actually don't like seeing people suffer just to get like in person. I don't really enjoy it, but I find execution and torture and the methods used to be fascinating.
Yeah. It seems like it'd be an intriguing book. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's good for like I like to read a beginner book about executions. Great. There's like execution, the guillotine, the pendulum, and the thousand cuts. Excuse me. Well, no. This is.
Oh man, that is a way to go.
No.
1,000 cunts. Wow.
The guillotine, the pendulum, the thousand cuts, the Spanish donkey, and 66 other ways of putting someone to death. And
1,000 cuts. It sounds like it sounds like death by your ex-girlfriends.
Oh dear God, that's not all. My ex-girlfriends are bad, just most of them.
I know
some of them were still friends of mine, and they might actually be listening to this podcast. I apologize already, but anyway, I do recommend picking the book up if you want some light reading, or might be heavy reading for some of you more squeamish types. Which brings me to, I'm reading it on my playbook right now, which I really enjoy because it doesn't bother Nicole while we're in bed, and I can read in bed without, you know, disturbing or waking her up, which is great. Sometimes I can't sleep and I want to do research. And my computer that I work...
Sometimes the ether doesn't last long enough.
No, of course not. And she starts trying to get out of the trunk, and I'm like, I don't want
her to... The chains start to rattle, and, right. And you're waking up everybody.
I don't want her to learn how to, like, you know, pick locks with her teeth. So eventually I have to figure out a way to keep from disturbing her through her ether sleep. So it's I had no idea what I was talking about all of a sudden. I lost track. I was like talking about, my work computer is in the bedroom, and so the noise of it will keep her awake. Well, you know, but my playbook makes absolutely no noise, and there's no clacking of typing noise, which also keeps her awake. You know, so it makes it really good. And so I love reading ebooks on my tablet. So nowadays I actually look at the option of purchasing books in ebook format. And today, one of my friends and my friend and an artist I work with, Mike Allen, suggested War Ghoul by Dave Brocky. You may know him as the singer of Gwar. Hmm. And War Ghoul, WHARGOUL, is, I'll actually read the copy. I destroyed your life. I raped your wife. I am the fucking War Ghoul. From the killing grounds of Stalingrad to the death camps of the Holocaust, from torture chambers in Iraq to race riots in the United States, the War Ghoul was there, killing and raping. It is the beast born in bullets and shrapnel. feeding off of pain, misery, and hard drugs. Cursed to wander the earth without hope of death, it is reborn again and again to spread the gospel of hate, abuse, and genocide. But what if it's not the only monster out there? What if there's something worse? I guess like Rick Santorum. From Dave Brocky, the twisted genius behind GWAR, comes a novel about the darkest days of the 20th century. The modern world is dying, and Brocky is here to put a bullet between its eyes and violate the corpse. This is all-out fucking war! Alright, so that right there makes me want to read it. I'm like, because of this.
Is he Odorous Ungus?
Maybe. Perhaps.
I remember.
Anyway, he's one of those dudes. And
yeah.
I know he's a nice guy. I've met him in person like a long time ago, and he was a terribly nice fellow. But
yeah, they seem like nice, pretty funny guys.
They're super nice. GWAR is probably one of the nicest bands I've ever both hung out with and worked with. They're just super nice. But the thing is, if anybody else had written this, I wouldn't even bother. Hell, I can't really give details, but I received a story from somebody, and it reads basically like the instructions of. It reads like what you should read to groups of people to encourage them to murder their fellow human beings who just need to be put down. Like, I read this guy's like manuscript, and I was like, holy shit, this is like the worst thing I've ever read. I really wish I could just email a fuck you like a whole bunch of times, like, don't ever write anything ever again. You suck. But this is actually probably entertaining. War Ghoul, I mean, it's probably entertaining, even if it wasn't by Dave Brocky, because it's kind of, what do they call that? What do they call that genre where a bunch of shitty writers actually make their shitty work popular? Bizarro writing. That's right.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, this is about like rape babies who have hearts for eyes. And you're like, yay, it's funny. And, you know, and you read it. And I do like this stuff. Like Ask Goblins of Auschwitz comes to mind.
Yeah.
And so War Ghoul seems like this. I would love to, I was excited. I'm like, well, it's $12 to order from Amazon.
So is this a book?
It's a book. Huh. It is a 240
story.
It's okay. A 244 page book from Deadite Press. Published December 4th, 2010. And it is $11.95 in paperback from the US, which probably means it's $1 million in Canadian money. And I wanted to get it instantly. I don't want to wait 6 weeks for Canadian Post to finally get shit to me. So I decided like, well, let's get it in. I like to buy this for, you know, in PDF format. It's $7.95 for the PDF format. Now, does that make any sense to you? It's $12.
In the sense that ebooks these days have a really weird wide range of prices, it makes sense. It makes sense in the way that sometimes you can get novels cheaper than you can get the Kindle version because the industry is currently fucked up because they feel like digital is a competition with your sales as opposed to a good outlet for new sales.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on who published it, either that's just the way shit goes or it's awfully high. If it's like, if they're putting it out themselves and self-publishing it and have more control over the price, that's high. Should probably be $5 or under.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
Cause you're talking about a fucking book that's like $12.
You can buy my
book for like $12 because that's how much it costs to print a fucking book. But I sell the Kindle and PDF version for like 99 cents.
Does it sell?
No. All of my readers are also listening to this podcast at the moment, Steve.
Oh, so millions.
Yes.
And that's the thing too, is like, you don't want to price something too low. Like I recommend make your book $1.99, but the thing is like $1.99, $2.99. That's where I draw the line for.
That shit sells too. The weird thing is when you price stuff at like the $99 to $1.99 mark, it sells a lot more.
Yeah.
It's strange how many people would just drop a buck on a book just because.
It's a buck,
but
man.
But they feel weird dropping $2 to $3 on a book, even if it's obviously higher quality.
How I pitch it to people is, you're not going to drop a buck on my book? You'll give a buck to a complete stranger who's begging for alcohol money on the street that you're going to go shit talk at the bar with your buddies, but you won't give your friend who took the time to fucking write a motherfucking novel a buck. You won't give him a buck. Like, you'll buy me a $6 drink at the bar because you want someone to drink with and drown your sorrows about how much your wife sucks, but you won't give me a dollar to buy my motherfucking book. That's because friends don't really support people's projects usually, but that's a whole other story.
Yeah.
I bought your book,
and it's
Ryan.
Much worse, I think, with stuff like reading where it takes a lot of effort and time. If you make a fucking video, you make a movie, you make a song or an album, that's disposable. It's shit people can do while doing other shit. It's stuff that's that goes down easy and they enjoy and can consume quickly. It doesn't take their brain doing any work, whereas reading stuff takes fucking effort and time. So I think people are just turned off by the idea, like, I don't have time to read your book.
Get it anyway. Like, yeah. I don't understand. Like, I almost feel like when I talk to people about buying my stuff, I'm like, well, look at it this way. Would you give me $5? They're like, yeah. I'm like, well, then go buy my fucking book. Go buy my comic or whatever. Drop the dollar or however much it costs and don't read it. I don't give a fuck if you don't read it. Just don't. Like, do you think it's any good? Well, I think it's kind of good. Then support me. So, you know, like, just do it. Like, I do it for my friends. Why can't you do it for, you know, like, and then that's my kind of mini rant on that. And I hope I don't lose any friends.
Make a little bit of effort. I mean, if your friends aren't going to help with the grassroots effort to get anybody else to read your book, why are fucking strangers going to shell out for it? And the weird thing is, strangers are the ones who have a lot more interested and invested in the process than your friends. Typically, they search it out and find it. They're like, oh, this is cool. I like this. Whereas your friends are just kind of like, eh, who gives a fuck?
That's because friends are the ones that never actually find you funny or find you interesting. Like, not you, Ryan, but in general. Like,
well, that's true about you, Steve.
Yeah, that's true. But I like to issue the following challenge to the listeners: you should buy Ryan's book, The Big Rusty Lie. For what, $1.99, and buy it now. I challenge you to buy it, charge it on your credit card or whatever. It's really easy to do. Ryan will have the link in the show notes, or you can just go to
Ryan's.
And
if you buy it on Kindle, I apologize for the formatting because Amazon can't do fucking anything right.
Whatever. They're not going to read it anyway,
their tools are really shitty. Like, the way it's formatted currently is the way it was when the Kindle platform launched in 2008.
Ryan,
I've never been able to update it properly because their tools just suck. Amazon does shit really badly for such a gargantuan fucking company.
So
it's amazing how badly they handle this stuff.
It's true. But the point is, buy Ryan's book. It doesn't matter if you read it or not. Just buy the fucking book. And Ryan needs the numbers, right? You want Ryan to write another novel and support your friend if you like Ryan or whatever. Or if you like me, if you're my friend, drop the 99 cents to buy Ryan's book. And when you pass a homeless person, you know, suck up your bleeding heart thing and just tell them, I spent the money I gave you on someone that actually busted their ass writing like a 400 or 200 page book or whatever. Well, how many words was it?
70-something thousand.
70,000. Give you an idea about how much this kind of shit runs. If I edit your novel and I like you, I'm going to charge you about between 5 and 8 cents a word. If you're in a role-playing game company, I'll probably do it for nearly free, but whatever. So 70,000 times, say, even 5 cents, like a good friend rate. Multiply that. That's editing costs for a book. Ryan did everything himself. He wrote it. He created it. You know, he created it. He wrote it. He edited it. He had his friends read it and stuff, and actually had to harass them to read it, and it formatted it, did everything himself, and is only selling it for $1, and it's actually a pretty damn good book. So why don't you get off your lazy fucking ass and actually go and just $1. That's all it takes. For all five of you listening, buy his fucking book.
I feel
book.
Like Sally Struthers is going to join in at any moment and start talking about the difference $1 could make to children in Africa.
It's true. Your dollar can make a difference with Ryan.
If you buy my book, I will personally go to Africa and kill Kony.
There you go. Kony 2012. Ryan's going to take him out.
Yeah.
And it's
your
like,
purchase of my novel will help defeat Kony.
Well, that's the thing, too, is like all the, I mean, I was going to bitch about ebook pricing, but that brings me to another bitch, which is people will complain that you're aggressively, you know, like I will aggressively promote something. And I'm like, let me get this straight. You will drop like $16 on an e-version, a download of an album by another man, woman, folk song / electronic act that's called like Tegan and Jim or some bullshit. You will drop that to listen to it while you're sitting there masturbating in the bathroom, but you won't drop like fucking 99 cents on your friend's project. I don't understand that. Maybe it's, and it's weird because I drop money all the time on my friend's projects. I will actually not get things so I could buy. And sometimes, sorry guys, some of your stuff I actually don't read. I just don't have time. But there's several comics I've purchased I never really read, or I just skimmed over them and said, hey, cool, good job. But I bought it anyway because I support my friends. That makes me some kind of mutant freak, I think. Because like what somebody I won't say who this is, somebody privately told me that when they did the Kickstarter project, It was very successful, but hardly anybody they knew actually did not support it until they'd already hit their goal.
Yeah.
So it's a really bizarre. Yeah.
There's a weird sense of hypocrisy that comes with friends supporting their friends' projects when it requires any effort. The choices they will make are very strange and often hypocritical.
Yeah,
it's very odd.
Don't get me wrong. I have some friends, and a lot of my friends are very supportive. I mean, personally, I have had
everybody seems awfully supportive when the support is free. When it's words, those are awfully cheap words that they're willing to give you.
Well, my friends that are the most supportive, it seems, and this is not an insult meant towards my real life in person friends at all, but the most supportive friends I have are actually long distance acquaintances who I've never met. They only know me as a professional writer or whatever. So, and I'm very friendly, and you know, it's just an interesting psychological dynamic. It's all I'm bringing up. I mean, if you don't want to support my stuff and you're my friend, that's cool. Like, I still love you as a friend and it's totally okay. Just don't be surprised if I don't come and buy coffee from you. So, you know, like that kind of thing. It's an interesting dynamic, I think.
Yeah, it's strange how strangers will often be the most loyal people and the most interested in the things you do.
It's because they only view you as this creator of a particular thing.
I guess they're impressed, whereas your friends are like, if he made it, how fucking good could it be? Fuck that guy.
Speaking of plugs, this is actually sitting by my desk and I thought I'd plug it again. Also, go to RPG Now, and actually I'm going to check RPG Now right now just to see how much this costs, because it's totally worth it, so you can help a local Victoria game designer. Is Where Is My Spellbook by my friend Douglas Lloyd. It is a fourth edition D&D and Pathfinder adventure by Black. Huh. That's put out by Blackburn Publishing. I highly recommend it. I have a home printout version that he gave me at Gotticon, and Douglas was on a panel with me, and he's a great guy, and I'm really glad I made friends with him, and I'm more than happy to support his Douglas. It's a fantastic adventure. So it's Douglas's first adventure. I hope he does more. He did a great job. It was a fan submitted work to Blackburn Publishing. So the art is going to be a little bit, you know, whatever, but pick it up. It's totally worth the holy shit. It's $1.50. It's $1.50 and is 15 pages. And you can, like I said, fourth edition D&D or Pathfinder. And if it's a great beginning adventure.
If it works with Pathfinder, obviously you can even use it with your third edition D&D game.
That is correct. And you can the great thing about it is it's a first level mini adventure suitable for 5 players using D&D or Pathfinder rules. Great for kicking off a new campaign or just making good use of a free Saturday night with friends. So, yeah, and you're supporting Blackburn Publishing, which is great. So that's my other indie plug.
That's something that seems to be working a lot better with online e-pricing, is a lot of like game related materials, particularly because I think there's just so many people that are producing fan products and then selling them for virtually nothing, as opposed to like, I mean, obviously there's a flood of shitty novels on like the Kindle store and like Smashwords and places like that where people sell their terrible, badly written, badly edited novel for 99 cents, much like mine. But with RPG products, you get a lot of people putting a lot of really good work into stuff and then putting it out there for like $1. I mean, obviously, there's still those companies that are charging $25 for a PDF copy of their rule book, but it seems like there's a certain amount of getting it that is going on in the RPG community as far as like digital publishing goes.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get that feeling?
That there's a what?
You're not paying attention to a goddamn thing I said. And I can fucking tell
looking at a question someone asked about
you son of a bitch. I was saying that the RPG market seems to get that digital pricing needs to be lower. They release plenty of great dollar product. There's a lot of like fans basically creating high-end product that they're then selling for really cheap. I mean, there's your occasional $25 rule book,
right?
But there's plenty of great stuff coming at a decent price. Do you feel like the RPG community is getting digital publishing a lot better than other avenues are?
Yes, I do. I think that are they getting it? I think smaller publishers are getting it. Publishers like independent producers out there who put out excellent quality product every time, like John Wick, one of my favorite RPG designers and a true inspiration to me, is, you know, puts out great stuff. People that like crafty games with like Fantasy Craft and stuff like and Spycraft, and a lot of like smaller independent Cubicle 7, smaller publishers that can put it out there. But some publishers like Fantasy Flight Games, they'll still charge like $30 for their PDF, yeah, which I'm just going to download.
Does Wizards of the Coast even do PDFs?
Oh, they used to. I don't know. I don't see them up in RPG.
Did they stop that as part of their whole like D&D Insider program or whatever? Did they start making all that available as part of the subscription as opposed to doing PDFs with 4th edition?
I'm not sure, actually. Mm. I'm assuming
Pathfinder. Yeah, I'm pretty sure Pathfinder sells PDFs and stuff, right?
Yeah, they do. And Paizo does a great job with their sales. I mean, prices vary. I'm usually upset by prices because I don't want
their prices are probably a little more middling.
There was
as opposed to being low or high, there's probably hit like right in the middle area where it's probably a little more expensive than you'd like to pay for a PDF, but they're not ripping you off and enforcing you to buy the print copy.
Mm-hmm.
You're so out of it.
No, I heard you. I'm just okay. So back to that.
PDF pricing, Paizo.
Yeah, Paizo does a good job. Wizards had, like, for a while, they were putting out all the old, like, second edition D&D modules. I actually bought a couple. They put them out for $5, and mm-hmm. they were all scanned, but they really, the problem was I would buy one, and they were terribly scanned, so I would just find a pirated.
Oh, yeah, it's, like, really fucking cheaply done. You can tell when somebody just doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
And they just do really bad, low-quality scans of stuff that wasn't all that well typeset and printed in the first place. So yeah, it looked kind of rough when you're sitting there holding it. And then when you do a really low res black and white, almost fax copy scan of the fucking books,
mm-hmm.
those things look like shit sometimes.
Well, I was going to say, I would just hunt down pirated copies. I already figured I paid $5 for the goddamn thing or whatever, $4.99,
yeah,
showing my support to a company. And then I'm like, there was some like 13-year-old kid out of Hoboken, New Jersey or whatever, did a much better scan of something he found at a garage sale. But that was the older days. Now you can't find them anymore. And it sucks because I actually don't mind. Another company that puts out quality PDF products is Kenzer and Company. But once again, I sometimes question like why they're charging so much. Like I will actually, they do have adventures like 15 pages for $3. I'm like, yeah. Whereas Goblinoid Games charges just the right amount of money, in my opinion, for Labyrinth Lord and Mutant Future products. They have a magazine that comes out that's 99 cents.
Yeah.
So, yeah, about the Wastelands, where you...
I mean, you really have to balance the amount of content that you have with a price point that is going to get you the most readers and purchasers possible.
Right.
If you're not... I mean... You want to get paid for your work, but at the same time, if nobody buys it, reads it, gives a shit about it, then how much is that work really worth to you? If you feel like it's worth $5, but nobody's willing to pay $5 for your 15-page adventure, then is it going to really ruin your life to set it for 99 cents? Do you feel like you're really losing money to actually increase your sales and get more people interested in possibly trying it out, since they're putting less of a gamble into your unknown product?
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are just too tied to the idea that the shit that they're creating is gold, and therefore if they're not charging a high or competitive price with the majors, or either charge what they feel like it's worth, then they're like losing money, quote unquote.
Well, that's or they see it, or perhaps they see it. I don't want to put words in their mouth because I know a few of these publishers and they're nice, they're actually really nice guys, but it's they're trying to like, they see like this money grab. They're like, oh my God. So I don't have all these publishing costs. So if I can get people to purchase this, by the way, one of my absolute favorites is Mongoose Publishing. They put out the Legend rule set for $1.
Yeah, I saw that. That was pretty interesting. I didn't buy it myself, but I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive that they did that.
Oh, I bought it. And so you can't actually, and I checked, you can't actually find, you can't find it in illegal torrent sites or whatever, because it's a buck, man. Just buy it. And the other ones are, of course, torrented, but they're still pretty cheap. I mean, they're not overly expensive. And if you, like I said, if you're going to, like, there's a weird balance. You got to think about the demand of your product as well. So, like, say when I put out Dolmens and Barrows, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm only probably going to charge depending how big it is. Like if it's like 60, 70 pages, then I might charge like $3 or $4. $5 at the most. And $5 is about as much as I'm going to charge for any kind of PDF. And yeah. I just think that, you know, it's... Oh, the other thing I absolutely despise, and a lot of my favorite people do this, is you buy the print copy. So that's like $30. Oh, you want the PDF copy too? That'll be $5.
Yeah.
Extra. So
I think it's great when companies encourage sales by doing the whole, if you buy a print copy from us today, we will give you immediate access to the PDF. Mm-hmm. And then
that's awesome.
When your book arrives, you got a PDF and you got the book.
Right. That's
PDF
awesome.
To access easily when you're wherever, look at it on your phone or wherever the hell you want. And then the print book to use normally.
Yeah, I like that model. And I also, companies that put a lot of work into their PDF, so they're bookmarked and hyperlinked and have all these neat little features in their PDF, I think that's worth an extra $2. If they say a fully bookmarked, blah, 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 give you a blowjob PDF, in addition to what I'm purchasing, I will pay an extra $1.99 for that PDF. But usually what I do, and I don't know if I should admit this in public. I don't know if it's going to cost me work, but I'll give it a shot. I will purchase a hardcover book, I will want to put it on my tablet or my computer as well. And sometimes I feel that I'm forced to find a torrented copy, like a free copy. Whereas I would gladly pay for it if it wasn't $20. I already spent $70 on your book.
They should incentivize you to, I mean, if you're giving them the money for a print copy, then they should probably incentivize you because it's free. There's nothing, the PDF is costing them nothing unless you're giving it to somebody else.
And it's what they use to
unless
print
they
the
can actually prove that there's a lost sale, which very rarely can you prove such a thing. They should probably just give you the PDF. It's not costing them anything. The distribution is pretty much negligible. It's
what was it called? Eclipse Phase.
Eclipse Phase, yeah. Eclipse Phase is completely open source, free. You can go to Demonoid and download the torrent that was put up by the publisher.
WizKids,
You can buy the book if you want to, but otherwise the game is completely free and open to mod as you see fit.
And they sold the shit out of that book in hard copy. Because it's a really nice book.
Apparently people really like the game. I had Eclipse Phase back when they were still early on working on it years ago. And it's not the type of thing that I find interesting. I'm not huge on sci-fi games. Mm-hmm. So... oddly enough, despite Warhammer related things, not really that big into sci-fi, especially not space related stuff.
Right.
I actually tried writing a kind of space opera sci-fi game once, but other than that, yeah, never a huge draw for me. So it seems like people really like that game. Like there's a huge fan community. I don't know if it's just respect that people just respect the fact that they did it and therefore want to support it. Because I mean, you can get a tremendous amount of goodwill just by making a big open source free game that anybody can have.
Yeah, not every game is going to have this kind of success. So it's kind of more like people just really liked it, they really enjoyed it, and they're going to. It's almost like donating money to the company to produce more material. But yeah.
So yeah. Probably a better method. Any game publishers out there that are paying attention, it would probably benefit you more to be a little free with the PDFs when it comes to probably pricing and giving them away with print purchases.
Or at least cheap. You know, like when you purchase something, which like when I bought, like, say, the video game, the full version of Legends of Yore, you get $2, but it said I'm gonna drop like $10 or $5. I think it was $5 I dropped on it. So when you put out like a PDF, price it low, give them the option.
Make it a fucking pittance. Make it just like a minor amount of money to cover whatever small costs you have, because really it's just gravy on top of the print copy they're already buying. I mean,
professional editors do
cost a lot of money. The bits aren't costing you anything.
Well, people have to make a living too. Like when you get editors, like one of the biggest problems in role-playing games or editing is a huge, huge issue. because the person proofreading is probably one of the playtesters. You really need somebody whose job is they're an editor. And believe it or not, I'm actually a decent editor. I know people who are even better editors, and it's an expensive process when you know,
but you can't take that out on the consumer by double dipping and charging them for the PDF on top of a game book as if it's two separate products.
I think they should be transparent in how they're spending it. They should say, this is how much this book costs to put together, or roughly, and they can always lie about their numbers or whatever. Who gives a shit? Who's going to find out? And then tell people, like, this book costs $10,000 to put together. The base cost for you to buy the PDF is $1. Pay what you want. And so some people are going to pay $1, and you can always come back and donate more. If you're like, holy shit, that was awesome. Here's $16 or whatever, you know? Like,
I mean, that's perfectly acceptable. But I mean, obviously, as we point out, usually the burden is not on the consumer to cover their costs.
Yeah.
If just because it costs them so much to make doesn't mean they can charge you more and just expect people to accept it and be like, oh, well, that's what it costs them, so I guess I'm going to have to pay an extra $10 for this game book. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way.
That is what
I
like to
call. As consumers, you can't just tell them, like, well, we spent too much money making the book, so you got to cover the difference.
That is what I like to call the consumer onus or whatever, where they, like, using probably one of the most currently overused words on the internet is onus. Is that, like, it apparently it's the response.
I think those people are actually trying to type anus, Steve.
I think so too. But they're publishers, and it's not, and also, like, not so much RPG publishers, because RPG publishers, role-playing game publishers know that they're working with a limited budget, right? So they know it's not a huge market. They know that it's a very, like, usually small and rabid fan base that buys their stuff. But we talk about ebooks. Like, at least a role-playing game, at least I know if I drop $10 on a PDF that's like 120 pages and I feel like I'm getting ripped off, at least I can reuse it and write the publisher and say, hey, I got a question. And they'll probably answer because they're only selling maybe 1,000 copies of it or whatever. But what sucks is, like, buying, like, a novel. You're only going to read the novel once. I believe it's like every 6 to 8 years, your brain... Like, you can actually reread a novel. It'll seem almost new to you again, unless you're like me, who remembers more of that stuff. But it's still, I mean, I've still reread old novels and it's still fun. But really, I'm not going to spend all this money on an e-copy, which could get deleted at any day, and assume that I'm going to read it in 6 years and it'll be just like reading it again. Also, there's just too many goddamn books. So you should feel fortunate that someone like me is reading your books. Or anyone is reading your books, because we live a very busy life. And it's just like, why charge $15 for a PDF of a novel?
Yeah. The content industry is really attached to the idea of just reselling you the same shit you already have in new formats. They feel like that's their big money maker, and it's what they need to force people to do, is prevent them from doing whatever that provides them with a copy without having to pay for another one. If you own the book, you should have to pay $25 for a digital copy of the same paperback novel that cost you $12 to buy in paperback.
Mm-hmm.
You should have to pay $20 for a movie you have on DVD to also have it on Blu-ray, because we don't want you to be able to rip your DVDs and watch them.
Well, that's another thing that they do is...
At least the games industry isn't terrible about it, because they are not a large content providing industry, but you have large scale book publishers, movie and television producers, and those people want to rape you in the ass constantly for every penny they can get over and over again. They want to, at least they've gotten past the days of releasing an edition that looks like it's got all the features and then waiting 3 months and releasing a special edition that actually has all the features you wanted and a director's cut and a bunch of other shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They've gotten past that because now sales are down. So they don't want to have to release multiple copies of the same movie. They release the one movie and forget about it.
Right. Right. Well, And that's the thing too, is there's movie companies have gotten the hint, and finally, and video game companies understand this as well, but video games are also very costly to make. But one of the things that is done that really irritates me is they'll say, well, this book costs $50. So you should be happy you're getting the PDF for for $25. And I'm like, I don't think you quite understand how this works. Like, I'm just going to go download it illegally. Like, I'm just going to go download it. Like, cause that's just, it's like asking for it, you know, but, there's also something, is it the DOJ, is the Department of Justice?
Mm-hmm.
This is over on Slashdot. The DOJ says Simon and Schuster, Hachette, Penguin, Macmillan, and HarperCollins conspired to raise the prices of ebooks,
along with Apple.
Yep. The report, any kind of douchebag move ever done,
any
is
kind
Apple.
Of conspiracy to jack up prices has Apple involved somewhere.
Yeah, you can't really blame them. I just wish Apple retards would realize, you know, well, I shouldn't say that because my girlfriend loves Apple, but any kind of Apple tards. Apple
my girlfriend, does not, so I can say that. Aww. People that use Apple products are a bunch of fucking cunts.
But to say that Apple, anyway, but seriously speaking, Apple does set the standard in these kind of business practices, and you know what? They're making money. So just being a granola eating hippie and an Apple fan is like kind of like being a Jewish Nazi. It doesn't make any goddamn sense. You're basically living the novel Mother Night.
Yeah.
From Kurt
you have to
Vonnegut.
Decide which hypocrisies you're comfortable with.
Yeah, you're the black SS guy from Mother Night. Do you understand?
Yeah,
okay.
There's no such thing as a purchase that is completely without harm. Like, I bought this and there was no slave labor and nobody was hurt and everything was
that goes
completely
to my rant.
Fair trade and blah, blah, blah. It's like that doesn't exist. Somebody is being fucked over no matter what you do, what you buy, where you buy it from. It's always tied us into some bullshit somewhere. So you just got to decide which hypocrisies you're willing to live with.
Basically, I agree with what Ryan said, except I'm more cynical and nihilistic about it, about the whole thing, in the sense that if you live in the Canada or United States or any other first world nation, you're basically dicking over the third world. But moving on, the report, this continuing.
But
report,
at the same time, they're getting rich. The third world is maybe not the people of the third world, but the governments of the third world are getting rich off of us while we slowly bleed all of our economy into everybody else's country.
Yeah, basically everyone's just getting rich. And it just goes to show that people haven't changed in 7,000 years.
Pointless political aside in the middle of a of a DRM, a digital format conversation.
So this continues saying the report originates from the Wall Street Journal, but the BBC adds comments from an analyst bizarrely claiming increased prices are somehow a good thing and thinking otherwise is the result of confusion. I'd like to see an explanation of why the wholesale model, while continuing to work fine, presumably for physical books, somehow didn't work for ebooks, and why the agency model is better despite increasing costs for consumers. By the way, thank you, Brendan, who is probably our favorite listener. See, yes, we're playing favorites, but Brendan always asks the great questions. And
Brendan is my favorite person. So
he gave me this.
All of you other people can just fuck right off.
And
Brendan,
including me. Yeah.
Brendan's the only listener we need at this point.
But it is a huge, and of course, Slashdot has a bunch of commenters that are a mix of retards and insightful people. So that's pretty much sums up everything. And paperback books are already way too goddamn expensive, especially in Canada. It's like $12 for a little mass market paperback. So,
Yeah, book prices haven't really come down, haven't really changed too much. I mean,
well,
now
we do when you go on
the
sale.
Digital, when they're getting remaindered because none of them sold, and so they've got to dump the copies somehow.
Well, that's when I buy them, right? I mean, that's the best time to buy a book. People go like, you know, oh, if you really can't wait to read the new book on the Franco-Prussian War, then you're apparently far sadder than I am as a human being. But, you know, like, I can't wait to read this Crimean War saga. You know, like, it, you know, you can wait a year, and the book will be priced from like $30 to $3, and you can.
But yeah, I don't know. Obviously, we've pretty thoroughly covered the whole pricing of books
and comic books and whatnot, too. By the way, comic book publishers.
Comics in digital format is just weird.
Holy shit, do not charge $5 for a 22-page comic book that's in PDF format. You are an idiot. Like, charge your 99 cents should be the maximum price for any electronic comic. I know art is expensive. I'm a comic creator myself. I understand that art is pricey and artists charge a lot of money. I understand that, because art is probably the most most work goes into the art in a comic book. But don't charge $2.99. the hell's wrong with you people?
They need to come up with some kind of program that is that really locks down the DRM, but basically lets you down, some kind of like Steam. They need a Steam for comics where they can sell a comic for a dollar or two and have that shit locked down so it can't be traded, can't be used by
anybody else. Well, they do. They have a reader. What was it called? Longbox? My friend Rance Holsey, cool guy, he runs a company called Longbox. They had a similar... I think Comixology has something similar. It's a reader you have on your computer that reads the, and then you buy the comic. And I beta tested Longbox and it was pretty cool. So, I mean, it's a...
Well, if it is the Steam for comics, that's what they need. That's what Marvel and DC probably need to get participating in. Because obviously their print sales are not great.
Oh, but they charge like $2.99 for a comic book. And then they bitch about not selling them. So whatever.
Yeah. I mean, that might be acceptable if it's really high quality, if it's really easy to read and looks great.
But
I
people,
mean, and if they're undercutting, I mean, if you're talking about a fucking comic that's at least $5 plus in paper. But well,
people also think like I saw a comic on Drive-Thru Comics that was a horror comic. It's 30 pages, which means you bring about 28 pages. It's an anthology, three stories. So three 10-page stories or whatever, three 8-page stories. Probably three 9-page stories. And it looked cool. Art looked okay. It didn't look anything that's going to win awards, but it didn't look bad. So it wasn't detracting. Lettering was okay. Basically an indie comic book.
Right.
$6. But it was marked down from $6 to $2.99. And I'm like, and it caused me to kind of rage, you know, about this. I'm like, what is wrong with you? Sell that motherfucker for 99 cents.
Yeah. The idea that it's marked down from selling it for like $6. Are you fucking kidding me?
Oh man. I'm like, and that's for the PDF copy. I'm like, no, I'm not going to buy that out of principle. I'm just not doing it. And I'm not saying that it's a shitty comic and the people that did it are shitty. They're probably great people. It's just that, if you want to entice me to buy your sight unseen, I don't know who the fuck you are comic, I don't care if you have a Lovecraft story in there. Everyone does Lovecraft stories. Everyone. So give me a reason.
Dude, even big comic companies, when they're starting some big new thing, they will try to entice readers in with some special issue that's only 99 cents. Mm. And that's fucking print copies.
Yeah.
You
Radical publishing.
No matter what costs you put into the creation, you can't look at everything as a matter of as a cost benefit analysis. Not everything can be like, well, I spent this much on art and spent this much time, therefore every sale must bring in this much money. If you look at shit that way, you're not going to sell any copies of anything. Look at everything you put into it as a complete fucking loss and then price it as if you're trying to charge a reasonable rate for the product that's being offered. Don't think about how much money you put into it, because otherwise you're just going to fuck yourself up.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, like, it's just people are going to do what they're going to do, and they learn the hard way, and people vote with their wallet. And that's...
Yeah.
I'm a much happier comic consumer if I can buy 5 issues for $5. But if each issue is $3... And I have that, that's how I see it. When I got my credit card and I'm online, you guys got to learn how to chisel people. Learn how to do this. It's a marketing tactic. It's micropayments. It works, man. I will buy 5 comics for $1 each without any hesitation electronically. But if they're $3 each, I am more likely, I'm not saying I do this, but I am more likely to just go jump on Demonoid or something and just start downloading. You know,
I know that you're not a big game player to the point that you spend a lot of time on Steam or anything, but people like go fucking apeshit buying stuff on Steam.
Stuff they probably wouldn't
normally play because of sales.
Oh, I do that with
imagine
apps.
Yeah. Imagine if they had like back issue sales where the price may be $2 or $3 to begin with, but after a few months the price drops to $1.
Or look at apps.
If you're willing to wait a couple months and then, or like collections where you get, say, 15% off the price by buying all the issues together.
Yeah.
That's fucking cash money right there. When people see a deal, there is a natural inclination to want to buy shit you don't otherwise want or need just because you feel like you were fucking saving money doing it. I would be an idiot not to buy it. I don't need it, but I mean, it's 40% off. Why wouldn't I buy it?
Right, exactly.
I'd be losing money if I didn't.
And it also works for things like Indiegogo and Kickstarter, where you're like, you're basically buying the item, but you see yourself as a supporter, a backer, essentially a producer.
And in Kickstarter, it also like ties into those instincts people have where they like giving money to like charity or playing around
gifts.
And giving money on Kiva and stuff.
And here's your
tote bag. You feel like you're part of the process of creation and you're giving to something that you have a personal stake in, and they give a lot more money than they would normally for the same product. I mean, I've only used Kickstarter one time, but I gave a fucking $100 for a few CDs.
It works on the same basis that like donating to PBS used to. I don't know if it still goes this way, but where you donate to PBS, and for your donation you get a tote bag or a Blackadder T-shirt.
They're pretty good these days with free gifts. Like they like $100-$150 donation, they give you like 3 DVD box sets and shit like that. Mm-hmm. It's probably because they're given a lot of the shit at like really at like cost.
Yeah. Or donating. Really low.
So basically they're still making money on giving it away with your donation, making a wide margin. But yeah, like that's the thing. Give somebody something to feed their charitable instinct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's good too. I mean, I plan to use Indiegogo.
And those avenues are working out great. People are fucking giving away crazy amounts of money to shit that they probably should not garner $100,000 on Kickstarter.
I just backed Dave Galler's and Steve Ellis's book, I think it's The Last Living Boy, I believe it's called. I backed Matt Forbeck's 12 for 12 project. I backed the Lamentations of the Flame Princess's new thing on Indiegogo. Like I back this shit frequently, like, and it's like $5 here, $10 there. And I just don't really see like very much money spent. And I usually get the incentive that gets me the PDF copy of the book. Sometimes I don't even take the incentive. I just donate them money because I like these guys. So
yeah, I mean, to a certain degree, I kind of hope that it becomes kind of an addiction for people at some point. I mean, have you ever used Kiva.org?
No.
It's a micro loan. Charity, basically. What you do is you put in a little bit of money and you help give loans to people in third world countries and whatnot. Huh. Give money to people in Africa, South America to help them like increase their business, buy more materials.
You become an investor.
Basically, you're giving charitably. You're not receiving any return on it. You're not getting interest, but you're giving money, which is being doled out by Kiva to like local banks who are covering any losses and whatnot. They are giving them the money, and then they pay it back usually over a period of like 6 to 12 months. And then you get like you see if it's being paid back, and you get paid back your money over time. And then once you get the money back, you put it into another project.
On one hand, I think that's awesome. And on the other hand, I think it's actually a sad state of affairs when you basically have to internationally panhandle to get your business started in a third world nation. So,
But I mean, at least it helps provide stability to what would otherwise normal, like be possibly shady or awful local banks. It gives them a little more backing. They don't completely rape people on the interest, though some of them do, though Kiva has gotten a lot better about like checking every bank out and making sure that they're good and they're not going to be fucking people over. So
yeah, it's the least we can do.
It's interesting. It's not charitable giving because basically you're loaning money that's being paid back, but I mean, it's a little something you can do. Sharia likes doing it. Mm-hmm. I found it interesting enough to put like $100 in and give out four $25 loans and then just keep doing that over and over again. Mm-hmm. Sharia really enjoys it. I think it's the same instinct that's being done with Kickstarter. I think people are slowly going to maybe get more addicted to it, which would be great because I've thought about doing Kickstarter before, but I don't really have a good idea to put up on there. So it's like, I'm not motivated enough. So I'll leave that alone.
Oh, you can totally do Kickstarter. You
just burn Kickstarter out so early in the game because I'm a lazy douche.
Oh, just figure out how much
you gotta deliver on fucking Kickstarter. But
no, just Kickstarter for republishing Big Rusty Lie.
Does anybody really want to see that?
Make it a low donation goal, and do it through Indiegogo, so you don't have a so if you don't make your requirement, you still keep the money.
Possible, but of course Kickstarter obviously has more buzz, so you have more likelihood of complete strangers just browsing through and deciding to give you money.
True, Kickstarter has more buzz in the United States. Indiegogo is what you go through in Canada. So, yeah.
But, yeah. But I'm not up in the land of shitty cheese, so
that is true.
Worry about these problems.
That is true.
So I think we've pretty well covered a lot of actual serious.
I think so, topics. Actually. Oh, let's go over reader.
Oh, I think that's a terrible idea.
Oh,
our listeners are terrible people who give bad suggestions, except for Brendan.
Well,
but one thing I haven't mentioned in a while is, we chastise people about commenting, but obviously if you would like to communicate with Media Gauntlet, feel free to send us an email at media@mediagauntlet.com, which we can read on the show, or if it's blackmail materials, we won't read on the show.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I was
just
say,
haven't mentioned that in a while, so feel free to email if you have any comments.
Exactly. Or get a hold of me and Ryan through our respective sites. It's we're pretty friendly, you know, add me on Facebook and start leaving horrible comments on my wall. Whatever. And another quick plug, I noticed my friend Jorge Oliveira in Portugal, I'm probably horribly massacring his name, sorry dude, it liked this, and he does this thing called the Thermidor Project, which is both a comic, and he does a lot of really cool music. He has an excellent cover of Down in the Park, actually. It's called Thermidor, and I'm giving Ryan a link right now, so you can link it in the show notes, but check out Jorge's stuff. It's actually quite good. So I'm just like, sorry, I can't multitask at all.
No, you can't.
But he also does, I don't know if you ever heard of, what was it? Conexion Bizarre?
Yeah.
Yep. That's him.
Ah.
So yeah. Like the same guy, I believe, unless I'm getting my wires crossed. But he's an industrial guy. He does this, Thermidor 1929 project, which is really awesome stuff. So he's an artist. He's a musician. He's quite talented, and he has a record label, I think. So the guy deserves your support. He's been doing it for years. I think he's been around for like 10 years doing this kind of stuff. I've known him from like Live Journal days, and like that's dating me right there. Real nice guy. I talked to him on Twitter. I think you guys, anybody who's listening, check it out. So that's what you get for liking my Facebook comment, Jorge.
Well, I think we had it at just the perfect length, and then you brought up listener questions.
Okay. So anyway, let's wrap this up.
Yes.
Anyway, that's all we got for this
week. Let's go build a time machine, go back in time, and then wrap it up.
Anyway, thanks for listening to our rambling podcast. I'm Steve Saunders.
And I'm Ryan Speck.
And until next time, we're sorry.